This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon and welcome to Health and Living with me, T. Xiaoyik. If you suffer from migraines, you will know that it is nothing like a normal headache. Not only is the pain intense, a migraine also affects your senses, it can cause nausea, and most importantly, it often severely affects a person's daily routine. So consultant neurologist Dr. Julia Shanaz-American is in the studio with me today to discuss what we can do about migraine and what are some recent advances in managing this disabling condition. Good afternoon, Dr. Julia. How are you today?
I'm good. Thank you very much.
Can we start with this making the distinction between a migraine and a headache, and so that we won't be overlapping in our discussion?
Right. I hope this makes sense. Headache, which means head pain, I guess, is a symptom. It's a complaint, right? Whereas migraine is actually a complex headache disorder. I guess you could call it that. It's not really a disease. A disorder of the brain, which is thought now to be a hypersensitized organ. The brain has lots of sensitivity to many factors in that particular individual. Mostly, they have an inherited predisposition. There is a familial tendency for migraine, whereas headache can be a presentation of, you know, any condition, really. You could have a headache, of course, with a cup of coffee. You could have a headache with an infection like dengue. Mm-hmm. So headache is like a symptom, but the diagnosis of what is causing the headache then becomes the doctor's role, whether it is migraine, tension-type headache, or cluster headache, which is regarded as a primary headache disorders, versus a secondary cause, which is, of course, what we want to make sure we don't miss, a brain tumor or anything like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And does a migraine always present with a headache then?
Actually, yes and no. There are many types of migraine headaches. There is a diagnostic criteria. These are available online and in many resource websites to aid doctors and even patients, you know, in the diagnosis of migraine. The symptoms in migraine, since we're talking about migraine, usually these headaches are stereotyped, meaning that they're the same each time and they repeat. Some people have symptoms which are called, we call them prodromes, meaning that they feel tired, they yawn a lot, they can be moody, irritable, crave food. Sounds like PMS, but it's also what we identify as prodrome. Mm-hmm. Then a certain percentage of patients develop an aura, A-U-R-A, which is usually visual, and these symptoms progress gradually. It doesn't come on suddenly. In the visual fields, they can get flashing lights, loss of half vision. And this is before the headache even starts. And this lasts less than 60 minutes, followed by usually a throbbing headache, which is usually half head, mm-hmm. but can be the whole head or the front. And these can last between 4 to 72 hours.
72
yes,
hours?
Yes, it could be a three-day headache. And after that is, we call it the postdrome. And when you live with someone with migraine, you can see it. They're very tired. They're still not themselves yet, even though the headache has stopped. And generally, it's a, you know, they still try and sleep it off, and then they'll be okay after that. Mm-hmm. So this is like the phases of a migraine headache, which is what we doctors try to identify to make the diagnosis more certain.
Yes. I hadn't realized that it it has such lingering effects. So we're not just talking about a headache at a point of time. As you've already said, it could go on for 72 hours, and then there's the impact after that. And there are statistics that say that migraine is one of the leading causes of disability in the world. But can you help us to understand that in the context of how it affects an individual in their daily life and routines?
Well, I think if we take, for example, a typical patient, a person who is living with migraine, generally it's a female, because females are more commonly affected than males by about 3 to 1. And it's usually the productive years, people who are less than 50 years old. Of course, it can even start in childhood, children with a strong familial genetic tendency can present with migraine even at, in after the age of 5. So there is disability because, well, as I described earlier, these symptoms can, there are symptoms before the headaches, during the headache, and after, which renders the person unable to function. Because there is nausea, very commonly. There is photophobia, the sensitivity to light, very common in office spaces now. Mm-hmm. And many patients have to wear sunglasses in certain conditions. There's phonophobia, sensitivity to loud noise, and even sensitivity to smell. So most patients then need to stay indoors at home. So many will be missing work. They have to take medical leave. Employers may not understand that because you have a headache, you can't work. But actually, the person is rendered disabled because they tend to have to lie down, typically in a quiet room with a bucket, curtains closed, a cool room, and they try and sleep it off. So if these are happening weekly, and if you think it's a 3-day headache, say, in the worst scenario, then how many days is that mm-hmm. you are unable to work mm-hmm. or unable to function, even to cook a meal for your kids? So that's where the disability is. Mm-hmm. So, it's not you can call it a physical disability, but it is a functional disability.
Mm-hmm. Mm. And is it well recognized, though? If somebody has to take medical leave, at worst, it could be 3 days out of a week, very frequently. Do employers recognize it? Do primary care providers recognize it as a disorder that they need to refer and give medical leave for, rather than brushing it off as malingering,
Yeah, no, it's hard. I cannot. I'm in a tertiary center. I'm not in the front line or in the clinic setting where the doctor may be very busy and is just necessary to treat the symptoms acutely, which usually is using an analgesic and maybe an antiemetic. These are necessary in the throes of a very strong headache and nausea. But I think there is a role to play with primary physicians, general practitioners, to identify that it is a migraine. And if the person keeps coming back with the same symptoms frequently and has to take a lot of medical leave, that person should be referred either to a secondary or tertiary medical facility where neurologists are able to render treatment correctly and appropriately, educate the person, and maybe help them to be less disabled. But, this is the kind of how employers look at these patients actually is still difficult because many don't understand headaches, migraines. Mm. So, yes, there is a lot of problems with recognizing this as a disabling condition. But I hope with more awareness, we can do something about this.
Mm. Mm. And even at the specialist level, coming to see a neurologist, there's almost, you have to subspecialize, become a headache specialist as well. And, If a person has to go through all those levels, for yourself, at what point is it that they come to you, and how many hoops have they had to jump through to finally realize that this is something that can and should be treated?
Yes, well, I see patients coming through the emergency department, as well as referrals from general practitioners, mostly, or sometimes we colleagues, neurologists, refer to each other, you know, if there is a subspecialty that we have more interest in. So I would sometimes be seeing these patients in this way. And the clinic GPs, some of them just, you know, have identified certain neurologists with certain subspecialties, so they refer in this manner. We neurologists, you know, we see headaches every day. The person like me who's interested in headache will see more. That's all. I mean, mm-hmm. we all still are able to diagnose and treat. It's just our own different, you know, services, maybe in the clinic with advice for patients may be different, you know, but it's still what we do.
Mm. Mm. And earlier you did mention that migraines are more common in women, 3 to 1. Why is this so? And when it comes to already an under-recognized disorder, and then you add to that the fact that a lot of conditions in women are not recognized for their significant medical burden. So first of all, why are migraines more common in women, and what are your observations in terms of whether it's being addressed in this within this gender?
Yeah, that's not an easy question to answer, because in the research as to why certain people, you know, develop migraine, because there are certain subtypes of migraines where genes have been identified, right? There's a condition called familial hemiplegic migraine, which is fortunately not that common, quite rare. And it can be a familial or a sporadic, means someone can actually develop this. But the genes have been identified. But it's not simple, just one gene is actually polygenic. And that one is actually quite disabling form, because it may seem like a stroke, because the person would become weak on one side with a throbbing migraine-type headache. So that's hemiplegic migraine. So the genetics in that condition, and there are other genetic conditions. There's a condition called CADASIL, and mitochondrial diseases, where migraine is part of the symptomatology and what represents these conditions. Mm-hmm. But it still hasn't helped us understand why it's more common in women. Certainly there's the hormonal aspect, where women commonly develop more headaches during the menstrual cycle, during menstruation, either before, during, or after. There is also the type called menstrual migraine, where they only have it monthly during that period. Mm. So this may be one of the reasons why there are more women who develop it, because they're very sensitive to hormonal change. But that doesn't explain why men get it too, or mm-hmm. young boys. So it's not an easy question to answer, really. Mm. But certainly it's, you know, the productive life of a woman, you know, having babies, getting pregnant as well, pregnancy can increase their headaches, or they become headache-free during the pregnancy. So it's all very a mixed bag. Every individual is different. Mm. So I can't really generalize, actually, or give you any more answers than what I have done.
it does seem, migraine, sometimes we throw the word around so loosely, saying I have a migraine, when actually it could be a different type of headache. But also, it hides the fact that it's so complex, actually. And after the break, we will go into looking at the different treatment options and what are the advances that are on the horizon now. We're talking about managing migraines today with consultant neurologist Dr. Julia Shanas-American. So stay tuned right here on BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. Welcome back to Health and Living. I'm T. Xiao Yik. In the studio with me today, consultant neurologist Dr. Julia Shanaz American. We are talking about managing migraines. And earlier, Dr. Julia has made a distinction between what you would describe as a normal headache, which is a symptom, and a migraine, which is actually a brain disorder. Dr. Julia, the term brain disorder, obviously, we should spend a little bit of time just looking at what's actually happening in the brain with a migraine and what's leading to it.
Yes, there's tremendous amount of research continuing to try and understand where it starts. Before, we used to talk about the migraine generator within the brain. It's just a term. I mean, it's electrical discharges. There are studies going on with functional MRI studies. MRI is magnetic resonance imaging, so it's a scan, and using various techniques, researchers have actually placed a patient in the scanner while they're having a migraine. Mm-hmm. There's one study where they had a person going in every day for a month.
I would imagine being in an MRI scanner, yes, would trigger a migraine in itself.
I think she was really a tremendous person to do this. But then they were able to see that, I know this is just what the results showed, that it starts in an area called the hypothalamus, which is actually deep in the brain stem area. The hypothalamus actually is a regulator for sleep-wake cycle, hormonal control, emotional connections as well. So although that is not the whole answer to the situation, it seems that these studies indicate there as the area where it starts. Of course, then the electrical discharges move. And there's a term called cortical spreading depression, where there is a move of electrical discharges around the brain. And as it moves, then the person will develop symptoms of nausea, hiccuping, even yawning. All these things move. And then the visual aura, because it's affecting the visual center at the back. And even, as you say, you know, sensory numbness, tingling, all these things will develop as the impulse is moving. Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess that's a nice way of looking at it, simplified. Mm-hmm. And then what happens is receptors are activated, chemicals are released, some will vasodilate blood vessels, then comes the throbbing headache. And these chemical reactions are where targeted treatments are being developed. And that's the hopeful treatments that we hope to talk about later. Mm-hmm. And these are amazing studies that have been going on for years, since the 1980s, to try and see where treatment can be targeted. Because at the moment, before these treatments have been available, it was all try this, try that, to be honest. Even though they worked, there was a limit as to how much they could do. So it's a very exciting time. There's a lot still being done in terms of researching how it starts. But in general, I tell patients that your brain is sensitized to many factors, triggers we call them. Can be your menstrual cycle, can be a hot day, the haze, travel, jet lag, food, drink, you know. Every individual will have these triggers. Mm-hmm. There will be a genetic predisposition, and then boom, you can get it.
And so if you have it, you have to live with it. How effective is it when you tell people to identify the triggers and to manage those? How much of it can you control?
Well, I think, I mean, I don't know. I've never experienced a migraine headache, even though family members of mine have migraine. It is all I can do to actually tell them that they have to know their headache, because their headache will be different from the next person's migraine headache. So a diary is usually what we tell patients to use for a month or two. It's not forever. Mm-hmm. And they really try and look at a pattern you know, which can be, you know, caused by a particular trigger, and if possible, avoid it. I mean, certain foods, of course, you would be able to. Many patients would be cutting out coffee and cheese and chocolate, but these are not that common, to be honest with you. Your menstrual cycle, you may get, you know, advice from your gynecologist on what to do, but in general, I advise patients on what to take during the menstrual cycle. They have to take more analgesics during that time, but that's what we have right now. So there is a certain amount you can do, mm-hmm. but of course you can't change the weather or the mm-hmm. other areas that are in your individual day-to-day, you know, environment. Mm-hmm. Yes.
So let's get to treatment options now. And, you know, with better understanding of what's happening in the brain, you've mentioned that you can target those directly. If we could look at what we've had in terms of treatment to date, the more conventional methods, and what are we looking forward or what has arrived now?
I think in general, there's... Well, three aspects, of course. The first one is educating the patient, empowering them to be able to do something about their headaches and tell them how, what to do, or help advise them when they have an acute headache, what to do. And so the other aspects are acute relief and prevention. You know, the first thing I say to patients, there's no cure. If I were able to reduce your headaches by 50%, I would be a happy doctor. But, you know, you may not be that happy about that, but that's the target we generally tell patients that we will try and do. So with that in mind, then I discuss acute relief, what to do when the headache is evolving or starting. Many patients tend to be avoiding analgesics. They have a aversion to taking medicine.
Especially over
many of them
the long
put
term.
On minyak kapal or I don't know how they do it in the office space or just have a nap, which is highly difficult to do if you're in a very busy office. And they tend to take medicines when the headache is very severe. But truthfully, most of the analgesics we have will not work when the headache is thumping with nausea. Generally, they can't even take a tablet at that stage. I always try to tell them to take the headache medicine early so they have a headache-free day for the rest of the day, for example. That's why disability is there, I feel, because they kind of allow it to stay. Mm. I don't have headaches, so I tend to try and say, you've got to do something to block it from spreading and causing you, you know, disability for the rest of the day. So taking even a paracetamol, two paracetamol tablets early when they know, gosh, you know, they're having something that indicates the headache is coming. Actually, I try and tell them that's time to take it. So the acute relief, there's so many medicines. Paracetamols, aspirin, simple analgesics, NSAIDs, we call them, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs. Then we have the ergotamine derivatives, which is Cafagot. And then we have the triptans, which is a designer medicine for migraine. So that's the only targeted treatment for acute relief we have, the triptan. And the only one in this country, unfortunately, is sumatriptan. So it's talking about all these things for acute relief and how to take them and when. And then there's prevention. If the individual is having more than four headaches a month, mm-hmm. we have a categorization, a classification of severity. There's episodic migraine and chronic migraine. Mm-hmm. Episodic also then is subdivided into episodic or frequent episodic. So if you have headaches less than four times a month, that is episodic and generally you can manage. Mm-hmm. If you're having more than four to 14 headaches a month, you are in the frequent episodic group and you are you have a high tendency, a high risk of developing chronic migraine, which is more than 15 days a month for 3 months in succession.
Mm-hmm.
This is arbitrary, but this is the way we categorize the severity and how to treat patients. So generally, more than 4 headaches a month, I try to talk to patients about doing prevention, something preventive.
Mm-hmm.
There are medicinal pharmacological treatments, but there are many non-pharmacological ways to reduce your headaches.
Okay. So let's talk a little bit about the pharmacological. Just this year as well, a new medication has been approved for the prevention of migraines.
That's right.
And I would assume that's for chronic, but perhaps you can walk us through that.
Yes, I think, all right, firstly, prevention, we have a selection of medicines from different classes, different types of medicines, which we would give for a period of 1 to 3 months in general as a starting point. Usually we look at the individual's characteristics, you know, age and weight actually is very important. Is the person overweight? And sleep patterns and all the rest of things that we look at. Then there's a selection of medicines, you know, in different classes. We have beta blockers. We have antihypertensives, actually, calcium channel blockers. And there are also anti-epileptic drugs, antidepressants, which really do work. And it is an explanation where these medicines will chemically block the headache as much as they can do, even though they're not specific for migraine.
Mm-hmm.
So once they agree, we discuss side effects at length, and I say, look, you have to take this every day. Let's try a month. And you use your diary, come back and see me, and then we discuss it again.
Mm-hmm.
If there's improvement, I say, okay, we can up the dose, or we can sometimes add a second drug, or there's other discussions about non-pharmacological means. Then we go on another month and then a third month. So there are targets to reach. And, you know, I work with the patient. That's how we do it. If they have side effects they don't like or the medicine's not working to their satisfaction, then there is a change.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we've been doing all these years. But this year, in Malaysia anyway, we have a new medicine to offer, a targeted treatment, meaning that we have science to prove that blocking a receptor will make a change to the headaches.
Mm-hmm.
So these are called CGRP, receptor antagonists. The one that's available in this country was registered in May. But last year was the time it became FDA approved in the US and then followed by, you know, Europe and the UK and Australia. So many patients now are receiving this treatment, and I feel there are unique characteristics with this treatment which makes it very, very encouraging. If I have migraine headaches, I would try and get this medicine for treatment.
Okay.
Yes.
Apart from the fact that it is targeted for migraine, as opposed to, as I understand it, the other medications are for other conditions,
yes,
and you're using them too.
That's right.
But on top of that, you know, what else makes it so effective? And what have you observed in prescribing it to your patients?
Well, I've started offering this therapy to a handful of patients in my clinic. But in general, these patients will have tried many of the other medicines that I've just discussed with you.
And gone through that
gone
process.
Gone through the ups
of,
and downs of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then it is an injection once a month. So it allows you to not have to take any tablets every day. It's a subcutaneous injection, which means that it doesn't require intravenous access. It's basically something, you know, like an insulin injection. So it's very easy to self-administer, which is great. So if you're not too squeamish with syringes,
mm-hmm.
and the medicine comes in a pre-filled syringe, you don't have to draw it up and all this rigmarole. And it's just basically doing it very easily. There are videos on how to do it yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And there are very little side effects. It is a humanized monoclonal antibody. And as such, it's very safe. And the only side effects that we've seen compared to what we call in the studies that they did comparing against placebo, which is the group that didn't get the medicines, there was just a little bit of constipation in a few patients, a bit of itchiness, and maybe a bit of irritation at the injection site a few hours after the injection. But in general, that's it. So there's no drowsiness, there's no weight gain, there are no other symptoms, side effects to worry about.
Mm.
That's the ideal thing.
Mm.
And it's very safe. At this time, the studies are still ongoing to look at safety, but in giving this to men or women, about children, I'm not sure, to be honest with you, now that I think about it, but certainly in adults, of course, it would be avoidable in pregnancy and the lactation period.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Earlier you mentioned that you've been prescribing it to patients who've tried everything already and those are not working for them, right? But what if you had somebody who isn't having a chronic migraine, but the episodic ones are severe enough and disabling enough that they want preventive option?
Yes,
what would you do?
I'm sorry, I can't remember the name of the study, but where the study looked at patients, individuals with migraine, and they were given these monthly injections, and some had never been treated with a preventive before. So these are called treatment-naive patients, this one group. Second group had tried at least one or two preventive medicines, and there's another group that had more than three or four treatment failures, I guess we could call them.
Yeah.
And in fact, in all three groups, there was definite improvement.
Right.
There was reduction in headaches, but it was more dramatic, more significant in the treatment-naive group. So there is, at this time, the indication for use is more than four migraine headaches a month. So it can be used for persons who have at least four, but they are disabling enough that you can receive this treatment too. Yes, of course.
Mm.
Yes.
Then I guess the only thing left is to weigh, the cost, and is it worthwhile for you to...
Yeah. Yeah. At the moment, it's cost and accessibility, really, because at this time it will be only available in certain private hospitals until the Ministry of Health enters it into their...
Formulary.
Mm-hmm. I'm not sure how long that will take.
But presumably,
and how many hospitals will have these medicines, you know?
It will probably be more expensive than anything else that's currently being used.
I think there would be definitely, if you one compares this medicine to a beta blocker, I know, which has been around for years and years and is very cheap, yes, there would be a vast difference.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas some medicines, antidepressants or anti-epileptics, and even onabotulinum toxin A, which I have not mentioned, everyone thinks is cosmetic, but truthfully, it has great impact in neurological disorders and chronic migraine. It is indicated for migraine. It is a 3-monthly injection, so it is expensive. And you can compare the cost of botulinum toxin and this injection. There may be a little bit of difference, but these two are both expensive.
Okay.
Yes.
All right.
And not many people are rendering botulinum toxin treatments available because of that problem. Is the cost, and then the doctors who do these injections are very few.
Right. Not just anyone can do it then?
No, there is a protocol for botulinum toxin injections, which is 30 different sites on the scalp and forehead and neck. So it is more painful in some way, and it's 3 monthly. Whereas Parsurta or Erenumab, this new medicine that we just have available now, is a monthly one injection. So there are pros and cons with all this.
Yeah. When we come back from the next break, we'll look at some of the other procedures that could be used. I've been reading a little bit about things like nerve stimulation and all that. But also, lots of people are looking at things like acupuncture, supplements. Are those going to be helpful? So, in the studio with me today, Dr. Julia Shanas American, consultant neurologist. We're talking about managing migraines. Stay tuned to The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. Welcome back to Health and Living with me, T. Xiaoyik. In the studio with me today, consultant neurologist Dr. Julia Shanas American. We are talking about managing migraines, and there's been more research looking at the pathways causing migraines. And so, just last year, a new medication has been on the market, which is the first medication to directly target the prevention of migraines. It's a CGRP receptor antibody. But there's also a lot of interest in non-medication therapies. Where do things like nerve stimulation and magnetic stimulation and all of that come in?
Okay, this is a lot to discuss. The non-pharmacological treatments are varied. There are herbal and vitamins and antioxidants that many patients usually try. Mm-hmm. The herbal ones are called Feverfew and Butterbur, but truthfully, their impact has been very, very little in what my patients tell me. Mm. There's another two, riboflavin at 400 milligrams a day or coenzyme Q10. At 100 milligrams three times a day or 75 milligrams twice a day. Now, these two are available, at pharmacies, particularly coenzyme Q10. They're safe. There is a study. There are studies using these treatments for 3 months, and they have successfully reduced headaches by 50% in about a quarter of the patients. So there is a role for these. But as I say, one would not want to be too optimistic about how it would help. But these two also have impact on general well-being, particularly coenzyme Q10. So we'll move on to the other modalities. Now, acupuncture, reflexology, massage therapy have all a place to play, as does yoga, meditation, stress relief, essential oils, or aromatherapy. I think individually, many of my patients are doing yoga and aromatherapy or essential oil treatments. I say, go ahead. Acupuncture, well, actually, there have been two studies I'm aware of. First, comparing what we call sham acupuncture versus real acupuncture, where sham means just pretend, versus medication. And acupuncture was as good as medical treatment. And there was another study looking at this, comparing acupuncture to no treatment. Again, there was a benefit. So acupuncture, I think, has a role to play. And because I'm an acupuncturist, I tend to offer this to some of my patients, particularly headaches in pregnancy, where medications are to be avoided at all costs, and it's safe to be done and has great impact. Mm. Reflexology too. The other neurostimulatory devices that are available online have also shown themselves to help. And I think there are choices to be made here on an individual patient who cannot take medicines because of side effects. Even the triptans, Imigran, has side effects which people have to avoid. So there is a device called Cephaly, C-E-F-A-L-Y, which is a device that you place on the forehead and stimulates the supraorbital nerves, which are involved in blocking the spread of the headache. There's another device, which is occipital nerve stimulators, but these are useful for other conditions, less so for migraine, but it has been studied before. There's also transcranial magnetic stimulators. And these sort of neuromodulate, they try to block the chemical reaction or the way the nerves are activated in the brain.
Mm.
And they have a role to play, but partly because they don't have any side effects, but certainly they are costly.
Right.
And not easily available, but you can get them online.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Again, a conversation about what works best for the individual, how much they're willing to spend.
Yes, that's right.
Mm. So for the neurostimulatory procedures, do you have to do them frequently?
The transcranial magnetic stimulator and the supraorbital nerve stimulator, which is called Cephaly, these two have uses in the acute attack as well as prevention. So there is programs on the devices to use in the acute attack and also to be done every evening for prevention and lowering of frequency of headaches.
Mm, yes. Okay, all right. Mm. Perhaps just a quick word on long-term medication use. You know, as we may be looking at more medications coming up as well, what is your advice to patients in terms of reviewing their condition and their use of medication? How frequently should be they assessing it rather than being on the same, perhaps old medication for a long time?
Yes, this is a discussion with the individual who has maybe improved somewhat with the, you know, living with migraine headaches. In general, I always find that one has the migraineur, I guess, the person who's living with mm-hmm. migraine, they cannot always control the air environment or their stress. There will always be situations which could bring on their headaches. So there's never a time where I can guarantee, okay, you're better now, just stop it and you're cured. No, there will be no cure. So there will always be a risk. And I think some patients will try and phase it down themselves. And I always say, have some at home. And if your headaches come back, just start the medicine back again. And generally that works. You know, they tend to email me or text me. I do give my phone number away sometimes. And so they know what to do or should we take this again or whatever. So I think there's always a role for phasing down these medicines. But in the end, many will have to take them back again.
Mm.
But, you know, in a lifetime, there will be phases of bad headache months and then they can disappear. But, you know, the person has to be so individually disciplined, you know, not too much and not too little of sleep, you know, regular exercise, hydrate well, you know, handle your stress. It's a lot and you can't always do that.
Mm.
So I think that as long as they know they have something that works for them, that's all you need really.
Okay. So just a final word. Migraine is, you know, still under-recognized, under-treated, under-diagnosed. What needs to happen to change this perception?
I think if you were a person who suffers from frequent migraine headaches, I mean, if it would be helpful to, on your own, you can, on an individual level, go on to resources. There are many websites that are very well informed where you can learn on the internet and educate yourself. However, I would not say that would be enough to be able to manage. You would still need to see a doctor and hopefully a neurologist who can help to give you the advice you need. Otherwise, awareness has to improve, and I think locally anyway, there may be a patient group forming a Facebook group and patient awareness where they themselves will help to improve awareness and education. There is a headache chapter in the Malaysian Society of Neurosciences where we doctors, neurologists, will try and do more. On the more global aspect as well, things have to change, yes. Mm-hmm. I don't have all the answers. I mean, of course, you know, you have to have advocates, support groups, and maybe even, you know, in the legal aspect or the work aspect, there's a lot to do, yeah. I don't have all the answers yet. But I'm gladly work with anyone who's interested, you know, to do more.
Mm. And I'm sure there's a lot more research ongoing to look into new pathways to treat migraine better.
Yes, you know. Definitely. There are other medicines coming through, being on, you know, being researched and being tested at the moment. Mm. I don't want to confuse anyone with all these fancy names.
Mm, okay.
But they are there, yes.
Yep. So we'll just keep looking for more answers. Thank you very much. I've been speaking to Dr. Julia Shanaz-American, consultant neurologist, about advances in managing migraine. You've been listening to Health and Living on A Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.